welcome to This Business of Music and Poetry podcast, where the life of a creative meets the real world. I'm Michael Amade, host of World Poetry Open Mic, The Michael Amade Show, publisher of World Poetry Magazine, musician, poet, and author of more books than I should mention. My collaborator and co-conspirator in this project is none other than Clifford Brooks. Cliff is the author of Athena Departs and The Draw of Broken Eyes and Whirling Metaphysics. He's the founder of the Southern Collective Experience and is the creative force behind the Blue Mountain Review. Our guest today is record producer, engineer, and musician Clark Hagen. Clark Hagen is a Grammy Award-winning producer-engineer with a world-class resume and a master of the recording arts. After graduating from the University of Colorado at Denver, Clark began to master his craft as a recording engineer while working with the legendary Bill Porter, whose credits include artists such as Elvis Presley, Roy Orbison, and the Everly Brothers, while at RCA from 1959 to 1964. After a short stint at Alan Martin Productions in Louisville, Kentucky, Clark moved to Nashville, where his trusted relationship with Porter provided the opportunity to work with the legendary Chet Atkins. In his time with Atkins, Clark engineered the Grammy Award-winning record in 1996 for Best Country Instrumental and was nominated again in 1997 for a record with Atkins and Tommy Emmanuel in the same category, in which he also played guitar. Clark's success with Atkins paid off and subsequently led to work with some of Nashville's top artists, including Ray Stevens, Alison Krauss, Brian White, and Jeffrey Steele, amongst others. He's a dear friend of mine, and he has a lot of great things to share. So, without any further ado, here is our interview with Clark Hagen. All right, everybody, here we are, and we're very happy. Cliff and I are very happy to have the Clark Hagen on the podcast with us. And I've been trying for probably over a year to get him on the podcast, and finally he's here. So thank you so much for coming. Really happy to have you.
So excited to be with you guys.
Awesome, man. There's a lot of stuff I know you're going to be able to share with our audience here. And so, one thing I think I just want to start with is, you know, we all start our art form in a very personal way that no matter where it goes eventually. How did you first fall in love with music? How did you find music the artistic, form?
Well, I think, like as all creative people, we sometimes have to experiment with different materials. I think originally I started with probably using my Tonka truck and digging dirt with the steam, and that moved to working with clay that I think about when I was like in preschool and kindergarten. That then I think as my brain developed and I got more intellectual, I decided to pick up the oboe at the age of third grade, when we were in elementary school. And I did the oboe for a year there, and then I switched to the clarinet, and I played the clarinet through about, I'd say, seventh grade. And was in the all-state jazz band, I remember, in seventh grade. And that right there is when I found the electric guitar. And I said to myself, what are the chances of me getting a date with an electric guitar or with a clarinet?
That's exactly what I was going to say.
I said, I'm going to try this electric guitar. And so I started playing in the eighth grade jazz band or jazz ensemble we had at West Middle School. And I chucked the clarinet. And so that's kind of how I started on the guitar. And one of the first bands I think that I put together was in seventh grade, because we wanted to be in the talent contest. And we wanted to go up against the eighth graders and beat the eighth graders, of course. And so we came up with a great name. We called ourselves Dow Jones and the Industrials. Cool. We did, I think, a song called Turning Japanese by the Ventures.
I remember that vividly. I played that with a band of mine too, right around that same age.
Yeah, you got it. So, and then the next year we did another band, and we went by the we're doing punk rock, and so we went by the band called the Butt Corks, and the next thing we spelled it with X. CORX, and the next thing you know is we're all of a sudden opening up for all the old 21 and 22 year old punk bands down at these like slumlord places down off of Wincoop right by and things like that. The other things, I guess, 13, 14 year olds up there playing like these punk rock songs and stuff, and And the next thing that we opened for Joe Biafra one time when he came through town and stuff. So that's kind of where it all started. And then I thought I would be a rock and roll star, you know, by the time I was, you know, 17, 18, 19, I'd be like working hard. Well, you know, that I graduated from high school. I went to college for a couple of years and found a program at the University of Colorado Denver that had a music program where you could learn how to engineer records. And their head professor was a guy by the name of Bill Porter. Well, Bill Porter was Chet Atkins' engineer from 1959 to 64. Nice. So Bill was responsible for recording Elvis Presley, Orbison, the Everly Brothers. Billy recorded Good Luck Charm that went number one for Elvis Presley. Billy is responsible for over 50 songs that were in Billboard's top 10 through that time period there. And he had 13 songs in Billboard's top 100 in 1 week while he went to studio BRCA. So that's the guy I learned how to make records from, him and Chet Atkins. And so I got a job out of college because I did my college internship, my senior, out at a studio that Bill Porter went to run out in Kentucky. And I went out there and I was able to fix the gear because my dad collected cars. And so I kind of had a little nose with hands on, you know, training or whatever you want to call it, fixing stuff and being creative again, fixing gear or fixing cars. And so I got a job out there after I did my 2 week internship over Christmas. They offered me a job when I graduated as a tech. So I went out there as a tech for 2 years and then I became the studio manager and I was hoping for bigger and better things. I wanted to win a Grammy and work on a record that sold 1 million copies. Now I thought that'd be my record that I'd be getting those awards for, but
needless to say,
down the road, I end up, I called Chet Atkins one day cause my buddy told me to do that. And Chet said, "Hey, come on over. And hey, I remember you when you came down with Bill Porter one time." And so I did that and I went and saw Chet and, he asked me if I was an engineer, and I said yes. And he said, "Well, hey, my friend Ray Stevens died 2 weeks ago, and he needs somebody on a project he's working on right now. Would you be available?" And I said, "Heck yes." He said, "Well, come over tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock, and I'll take you over there." And so sure enough, he took me over there at 10 o'clock, and the next day I had a job with Ray Stevens working on his movie called Get Serious. And he was recutting all his old hits like The Streak and The Mississippi Squirrel and Guitar Zan. And
I know exactly what you're talking about. Oh, my God.
So I got to recut all those hits with Ray and everything, which is cool. And so then the next thing I know is I had Chet ask me to record him. And I had recorded Chet's last three records before he passed away. And I won a Grammy with him when I was 27 years old. And got nominated for another Grammy with him and Tommy Emmanuel on another record. And then his last record was a thing that they did. There was like a history of some country music that he covered one song on. But it was an amazing time, I got to tell you, being around cats like that and watching how they make music. It was such a trip. I got to tell you, like one of my first sessions I saw in Nashville was with a graduate friend of mine, Ed Simonton, who I graduated with. And he was working out of a studio called Nightingale, and they were doing a session with Tanya Tucker. Mm. And so I'm watching, I'm just kind of like a fly on the wall. I'm sitting there watching it. And the guys come in, they haven't heard, they say, "What song are we doing?" "Well, here, check it out." And they played over the speakers. These guys are writing up this chart, and they go back in the studio and they're like, 1, 2, 3, 4, and they knock it and they knock it out. And it's like, wow, that was amazing how they did that. And then if the producer wants them to change some parts where they can have them do it because they haven't practiced a part for 2 weeks in their head that they can come up with something else just to play with feeling. It was amazing. And it was like two takes in, they had the song. And you're just like, wow, that's amazing. Like, that's how hillbillies do it down here? Oh, my God. Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. I mean, it was truly
incredible. We don't play. We don't play down here, man.
Right. We just write some numbers down on a little piece of paper and go out there and 1, 2, 3, 4, get it out of the park. And it was amazing. Man. So, I mean, it was such an eye-opener and a realization of like, wow, we have no clue what it takes to make records in Colorado because I'm a native of Colorado. And it was just amazing to watch that go down. And that's how records are made. These guys, creative skills were off the charts, the studio guys. I mean, how they would come up with stuff, little licks, and staying out of, you know, like the hardest thing to do is to lay out. Yep. Everybody likes to play from the beginning till the end of the song. It's kind of funny, but the hardest thing to do is to lay out. And that's really where you really learn how to make records and be really all about. When it comes to what we're competing against. And I think that's a hard thing that we have against in any art form that we are. If we're not in a place where a metropolitan or somebody where people truly appreciate our art, whether it be music or paintings or sculpting, I think sometimes it gets some, we get down on that, you know, or we're not appreciative or whatever. And I wonder sometimes as artists, we need to go make that move. We need to move out of our Colorado and move to LA, move to New York, move to Nashville. What are we competing against, right?
Well, you told me.
Songwriting, I mean, for sure. I know that me and Michael have talked about that too.
Well, one of the first things that Cliff said to me. Yeah, one of the first things you said to me that I remember being pretty poignant. He's like, well, the reason most of the stuff hasn't happened is you never went to Nashville. And it was just like really matter of fact. And I was like, damn it, he's right.
Well, you know.
Well, you know. And, you know, the crazy thing is I've taken a few artists with me to Nashville. And Scott Gray with Union Gray is the last one. And it was amazing as a producer to watch your artist jaw just hit the floor when these guys don't know him for nobody. And they hear his song and they go out there and it comes out better than he ever anticipated. It's truly amazing to watch that go down. Because then they're like, oh, my God, I got to get my game on because I'm going to get shut down by these guys or whatever. I mean, it's awesome to watch that happen. And that's the creative part I was talking about, even like earlier at the beginning of the show, that, you know, being creative, I think, gets us off. Whether we're doing the painting or the sculpting or the music and stuff like that. And then when we build something that comes from our heart or our soul, or we believe in so deeply, it's amazing when it does get appreciated or people say, man, I get that. I get what you're talking about. That was me, or, you know, who knows, whatever it is, you know, I mean, that's exciting to me. That's some, I think sometimes that's worth more than money can give you. You know, when you have actually human beings come up and are pleased or jazzed by something you created, and that's cool. You know, maybe that's the fall of us as poets and musicians and everything, is when we don't get that appreciation, we get downtrodden, and maybe sometimes we write a better song or we create a better piece of artwork for that. But it's amazing. I think sometimes we're also earning, or what I'd say, for acceptance. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, and you were, I mean, one thing that I think you're talking about too, is it, you're showing kind of the power of the network, you know, about kind of how you got brought into that world. And it wasn't right. Like they were, it sounds like kind of two points really come out of that. It's one, the network's there. But two, you were someone who was able to be a tech and you were able to do the engineering, so that, and it wasn't like Chet Atkins was saying, hey, are you the best engineer on the planet because Ray Stevens needs an engineer? He was saying, hey, I know you're cool. I know that you have the skill set. You know, my buddy Ray Stevens needs this, which is one thing, but also, you know, and I know how you are. You know, you're not someone who talks yourself up. You're not someone who puffs yourself up. But I do want to highlight that for anybody listening, that you had to be good enough to stay in that room.
Yeah.
You know, like you were given the opportunity, you had to be good enough. And I've heard you, I know you're good enough, man. You got some amazing skills. You've taught me a lot of things that you learned from some other artists. And, you know, some of the big artists like Chet Atkins, you know, some of the advice you gave me about even finances as an artist, I've taken seriously and kind of started working with my own life. You know, so many people listening to this want to be recording artists or producers or, you know, whatever. What is something that you've learned from the people who are kind of at the top of their game that you think is important for people to know that maybe they don't use, you know, you don't see very often?
I think sometimes the biggest thing we have to make an artist is over the art versus commerce angle.
And I would say that when we talk about that, what we're talking about is, am I going to write something that's going to be commercially a hit, or am I going to write something that's meaningful to me and only to me, and I don't care about the commercial, the money on it, you know? That's a big thing, you know, because there's a lot of great artists that they don't care about being the next Britney Spears or whatever, or, you know, big time Justin Bieber or whatever. And they just care about being able to make something and hope one person gets it. If one person gets it, we're satisfied and we feel so blessed and everything. And then we have the other people that feel like they need to impress 10,000, 20,000, 60,000 people. Otherwise, I suck. And that becomes a commercial thing. So that person has to start making different decisions than the artistic decision. And I think that's the biggest thing that we face as artists. And maybe some would call it selling out or whatever we want to call it. But that's a decision we have to make, you know, on what we're trying to accomplish here. What's our game plan? And what are we going for here? Those kind of questions also help me as a producer working with an artist, so I know what we need to focus on. Because maybe it's just a singer that I'm working with. I got to find her the right songs then. And the one songs that are going to be in the direction that we want to go towards. And what would that be? I mean, that becomes a big different thing than somebody just playing guitar on their porch and writing some songs here and there. So I think those are things as artists sometimes we have to ask ourselves and be truthful with. Because maybe to be an artist that we're writing hit songs, that takes a lot of dedication. It takes a lot of sacrifices you have to make, whether they be with your family or for yourself. Mm-hmm. And you got to be willing to do whatever it takes to get there. You can't be like, I had one artist, this nice girl, and she was young. We did some songwriting, and she was taking some pictures with my buddy, and she kind of got offended by some because some of them looked too sexy or something like that. And then I didn't get to see him because for whatever reason, it was like, and I felt bad because she was missing out on being professional and making a decision together as a team and so forth. And so it ultimately ended her drive because she's like, well, I don't want to have to look like that if that's what it takes to make it and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, when you're trying to compete against Taylor Swift and, you know, she's like 14, 15 years old and, you know, there is part of that, you know, you got to make a decision there. Does that make sense? And so they're also responsible for the decisions we make through either our integrity or whatever we have going. That makes a difference as to what street we want to drive down. Does that make sense?
Very and, much. And you
guys, oh. The other artists that they're willing to, they don't care. They're willing to do whatever it takes to do it themselves. Or you run to artists that they feel they've worked with producers or studios, and they thought that was going to be the thing that was going to take them over the top and get them noticed and get them signed. And when that doesn't happen, then they get mad at you as a producer because they didn't get a record deal or they didn't get signed and they spent all this money with you and da, da, da. And I almost say, but, you know, a lot of times I tried to give you advice. You didn't take it and you chose your own path. And here we are again. And now we're at a point where you're recording your own songs, you're writing your own songs, you're singing your own songs, you're producing your own songs, you're mixing your own songs, you're mastering your own songs, that, you know, then your product starts to go downhill because instead of, I heard a great comment from this lady. She says, A players try to find out A people to work with, where B players always find C players. So that way they have this ability to be above everybody. And then I'm like, yeah, but then the product sucks. I'm like, yeah, but they don't care at that point because then they're in control of it and they're the ones deciding whether it goes out or not. But then I feel like in order to find really good music now, it's hard because you've got to sift through all this bullshit to really get to great artists and so forth. And as I've talked to Michael a lot of times, the market we're in right now, music is being manufactured. It's not being captured anymore. That's a big problem. I was hired as an engineer to capture Chet Atkins playing his guitar and make it sound great. I wasn't there to put him in Pro Tools and copy and paste and fix a bad note here with pitch corrector because I caught it and he didn't. Give me a break. That doesn't happen. And that's changed now to where we're manufacturing music. We're taking artists that maybe aren't as good, but because they a thing or a fan base or something like that, they're we're able to sell product, you know. And I, this is a great example. Is I keep forgetting her name, but there was a girl that was on Dr. Phil, and she kept telling him basically to suck it or shut up or whatever. And they're all of a sudden the industry, I thought she's called Bad Baby or something like that now. And the record label's yes. like, took this going, oh my God, you see that girl that pissed everybody off? Dr. Phil's, you know, a client. Let's get her doing rap and stuff and da da da. And they do. And because she's got this fan base built up of haters, all of a sudden she's got a fan base of people that listen to her music. Because believe me, I was like, I got to hear this. I got to go see the song and check this out. Oh my God, there's the chick that Dr. Phil was totally thought she was nuts. And here she is as a rock star now. I mean, it's interesting. So to me, that was looking for the most, the best artist, the best guitar player, the best whatever, you know. That to me is like, oh, hey, look, there's a fan base. We can sell product. I bet you we can make you into a rap star and we'll sell some rap songs. And sure enough, they do. And that's sad for artists nowadays, too, because there's a lot of great artists there, you know, that are out there. And I don't think they're getting the recognition or the break that they deserve. And as the public of getting music, we're not getting the best artists now out there anymore because it's become a manufactured thing. And that's sad to me, you know?
You know, I think
poetry, it's like, just let me finish real quick. It's like, remember when you could go to a bar or a bookstore and you could hear poets speak their lines and tell you their story? People weren't talking behind the poet going, hey, Mike, Merrill went to Starbucks and da da da. Tell that poet to be quiet. I can't hear you, you know? And that happens with the singer-songwriter places, you know? With listening to songwriter places here in Colorado, that you go to a coffee bar and they got singer songwriters there, but I'm hearing people in the back of me talk so loud because they can't hear themselves over the singer songwriters. It's sad. And I feel like in the Bluebird in Nashville, you get kicked off if you were talking in the bar when it's singer songwriter. So we're missing out on a lot of amazing art. And maybe that's why we're not finding the best artists in so much, because they're there. We're just their background music, their background noise for.
Well, and maybe some of the best artists aren't also the best at promoting now too, right?
Like, yeah, that's true.
That's but I think what you said, something that I just want to highlight, is that A players find other A players. And now I think it has a lot to do with, and even what you're talking about now with the songwriters are playing, and you and I are talking Colorado, you know, Cliff's in Georgia. I don't know if it's much different there for you. But
they have somewhat of a scene there with the rap and the hip hop going. You can't deny that.
Yeah.
You know,
but at the same time, I think a lot of it has to do with respect for yourself as an artist, right? And saying, I'm going to take myself seriously. I'm going to find A players to work with. I'm not going to come in and start at this smaller level and try to earn my, I'm going to come in and say, I'm an artist with an act that has a point of view. And this is this takes me to a thing I wanted to highlight for everyone listening. And we've had a lot of music guests, and they all have one thing in common. And this is something you've told me about, is the mark of a professional musician is picking a direction.
Yeah.
Choosing a vision, choosing where you're going, putting everything behind that. Now you and I have talked a lot about this, how there's all kinds of people who go over the place with their vision. They have a reggae song and a hip hop song and a whatever. But could you expand a little bit on that for people listening? Because I think that's a trap lots of people fall into.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the thing that's great about the way music is right now is I don't have to do an LP with a direction. I can do a couple sides with the direction and see how that goes. A lot of things I found with artists that I've seen artists make mistakes. And it was this one guitar player that was in this very famous band from here in Denver. And he was trying to do his music, and it was like a reggae song, a country song, a rock song. And I was kind of asking him what's your direction with this? He's like, well, we're just trying to, you know, put stuff out there and see what people like. And I'm like, going, so if they pick you doing hip hop and that's not much your style, you're going to be the hip hop guy then, because you got the record deal doing the hip hop and that's your band's direction now. And I found that kind of funny to me. And I remember seeing an A&R guy from Universal from LA one time was in town talking to these Boulder students. And that was one thing he said too. And I think your brother was there too, Michael, with me, David. And he said about how band needed to have direction. Otherwise, he can't look at them, because then he's like, what, am I supposed to figure out your direction? Mm. And am I supposed to figure out your fan base? Am I supposed to figure out the people that are going to come to your concert or buy your material and stuff? He's like, you need to have that figured out, that then I can, you know, figure a way to promote it.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's very true that I find that very true. Kanye West was that way. I just saw a thing on Lynyrd Skynyrd. You know, those boys had it all together. Then I'm watching Al Kooper, who produced those boys, talk about how they came in and knocked out the record and didn't do like any overdubs or anything. It was just like, boom, because they've been practicing it so much. Wow. And it was like the easiest record I had to do, because those guys have been practicing so much that they knew every part, they knew how to play everything. And that was amazing to me. And that's what I think it goes back to again. And being able to have that songwriting thing, you guys know well, it comes down to the song. I can have a terrible song that's recorded great, it's still going to be a terrible song, but I can have a great song that's recorded bad, and it'll still be a good song.
Yeah,
and I think that's the thing that we miss out in our music, is the songwriting. It's always about the song. It's not about the rap drum beats you put in there, or this is a rock song, I'm gonna put a banjo in there, we'll call it country. Yeah, all right, that's modern country, right, boys?
Yeah, because it's so true.
Right? And it's funny because, you know, my feeling on this is modern country is because a lot of cats moved from LA to Nashville in the late 90s, early 2000s, when all of a sudden you see Peter Frampton showing up, Sheryl Crow showing up, Kip Winger showing up, you know, and I get it, because, you know, the songwriting community in LA to me totally broke down for what kind of songs they're looking for. So all those artists, they came to Nashville because that's where songwriting was going on.
Yep.
And now what we have into is that we have all these producers and songwriters from LA are in Nashville, and that's why it's kind of turned into the rock scene now, you know, because none of the stuff coming out of the bro country sounds like traditional country music at all. Right. But they put a banjo on it, and that's funny to me. So as an artist, getting back to like direction, well, if I want to compete in bro country, then I better figure out how I get a look like bro country. I got songs that are like bro country. Otherwise, I'm just going to be, you know, set aside, and they're going to laugh at me and go, maybe when Garth comes back, traditional country, you know, it happens. It's happened in circles. And a perfect example of that is when Brother When Art Thou came out, all of a sudden bluegrass was cool. And yep. I'm like, going, yeah. And all the songs on the movie there are from the 1920s and 1930s. And you're just discovering them now and are amazed at how cool they are. And that drove that genre crazy, because I've lived in Colorado all my life. I didn't know what Rocky Grass was.
Yeah.
And it's sold out all the time. And that's the Bluegrass Festival in Lyons, Colorado. That's amazing to me. So, do you know what I mean? That's tough, you know, and I like, and your genre, what's your genre going to be? Is it going to be bluegrass, or that's a tough genre to get into, because those are great musicians.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, those are things that artists, we have to really focus in on what we're trying. Even like a Bob Ross that does Trees and Water.
Yeah.
Or do I want to be the guy that does Castles, or do I want to be the guy that does Hot Rods like Big Daddy Roth or something cool, you know?
Yeah.
That's what I think. There's a direction, right?
Yeah, yep. Absolutely. Well, I mean, and I think that's a, you know, excuse me, Clark, there's so much we could get into. I mean, you and I have literally had many hours of conversations about this, and I always look forward to it, and I never get sick of it. One thing, just because of the length of this podcast, we're definitely going to have you back if you're up for it. We could keep going. But I want to ask just one kind of last question here, which is just, I mean, we touched on direction, we touched on going with A players, we touched on all that. But for any artists who are listening, whether it's poets or musicians or whatever that are listening to this, if you had a piece of advice you could leave them with, what do you think you would impart?
One thing I'd impart in is don't put out anything but the best you can do. Putting out mediocre stuff and a lot of mediocre stuff is going to do nothing but just derail you. And then people don't get to see the best of what you have to offer. An example is like in Nashville, they think that a songwriter needs to write 30 songs to write one hit song. So if I write need to do 10 songs on my next record, does that mean I need to write 300 songs to get the best 10? You know, and that's part of it. I think we don't give ourselves credit. You know, as artists, like a lot of musicians I deal with this, they come in like, oh, here are my 12 songs. And I'm always like, why don't we pick the best 8 or 6 of those instead of you putting all this money into 14 of them and you only have one shot to get all these 14 out in front of people's faces instead of a couple here and a couple there. And so it's a marketing thing again. So just think that's the biggest thing I think that's changed so much that imparting advice on you is it's a bigger picture now that as artists, we have to handle more business than we had to in the past. And that's with our marketing, our salesmanship, our promoting, our creating the product. So as artists, I think we need to be careful on what we put out to the public, because you should put nothing but the best out there. Because we put a lot of mediocre stuff and one best thing out there, then we're not really seeing ourselves as the best it needs to be. We only have sometimes one chance or two chances at this that we get a shot of somebody being exposed to our creativity, that I think we need to be subject to watching what we do put out and only put out the stuff we're proud of. In Nashville, I was told you almost got to write 30 songs to equate to one hit song. So if I have 10 songs I want to do with you as a producer, have I written 300 songs? And that's just a way to think about this in a lot of ways. So I don't want to put all my 300 songs out there and then find the 10. I mean, so be real with yourself and realize that music business now is you've got to take care of a lot of business yourselves, whether it's the marketing, the promotional tool, the making of the product, the distributing of the product, all that stuff, the selling of it. That's now on the artist's face and shoulders now, that becomes harder and more time they got to spend doing that than being creative. So that makes it a lot more difficult now. And just realize, though, that those are part of the deal. The people that make it are the people that are willing to put in 110% of all this extra work they got to do in order to be successful.
Both Cliff and I want to say thank you for spending your time with us. We want to say thank you to Clark Hagen for a fantastic interview. You can find Clark at clarkhagenproductions.com. You can find Cliff Brooks at cliffbrooks.com or at southerncollectiveexperience.com. You can find myself at michaelamadei.com and worldpoetryopenmic.com. Until next time, remember to be yourself. The world needs your authenticity. Do the hard work and conquer your obstacles creatively. Remember to follow your heart. For it's easy to lose your head in this business of music and poetry.